Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another Retail Focus. Trent and Leighton Kling with you as we discuss growth in the dollar store sector, as well as movement in the convenience store industry. But first, we begin with the news that dominated the retail news cycle during the latter portion of last week, as Sears announced just a horrific quarter if you are a shareholder. Many came away from that wondering if this could be the end for the longtime brick-and-mortar retailer. And what's interesting, as you break this down, Sears same-store sales actually decreased by more than Kmart same-store sales. There was some concern a year or even 2 years ago that Kmart was the store dragging Sears down, and the numbers we got from the last quarter certainly suggest that it could perhaps be the other way around.
Yeah, Sears definitely appeared worse than Kmart. They came in having negative 7% same-store sales, and this was actually the eighth consecutive loss for a quarter compared to Kmart's seventh consecutive loss. So actually, both stores are hemorrhaging sales, but Kmart only fell 3.3%. So actually less than half the amount of same-store sales that Sears came in with for the quarter. This last week was when they announced earnings. They reported for the quarter ending July 30th. And again, this occurred on Thursday morning, August 25th. Overall, this is a horrible quarter for Sears. They were in the headlines heavily. And I think it's kind of funny to see this because the media is reporting on a company that now only has a $1.5 billion market cap. And so Sears right now is just hemorrhaging cash. They're really trying to stay afloat via promotions and sales, but people are still not coming to their stores. And it really is evident from that same store sales number.
Do you see this as a situation where perhaps these two retailers being tied together is worse for both of them? It seems like perhaps if they were separate, they might be able to work things out on their own. You're not seeing too many synergies anymore because the Craftsman brands and the Kenmore brands haven't been beneficial to Kmart.
Yeah, and that's one thing that was kind of talked about in this earnings call was the large appliance division and the Craftsman deal. The Craftsman didn't work out. They thought that the synergies by having Kmart offer the Craftsman goods within their stores were going to work out in the long term, but that's actually proven out not to be the case. People still want to go to a Sears to buy their Craftsman goods. You don't typically think of hardware and think of Kmart, so that's still not there. They had a failed execution on that front. And then with large appliances, they cited increased competition overall. So that's a very good point you make. The Kenmore brand still has a good quality behind it. People think of Kenmore and they think of a quality brand there. Now with JCPenney coming in to that large appliance environment competing, and then a ton of sales with Home Depot and Lowe's on that front, Sears is really trying to figure out how they're going to compete with large appliances, because for the longest time, Sears still had large appliances to cling on to, but now you also see consumer electronics falling by the wayside, just as Best Buy actually recorded a fairly decent quarter.
Yeah, Best Buy's same-store sales, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, actually improving over the last quarter, which was unexpected, or at least somewhat unexpected. As far as Sears is concerned, they are seeing a reduction across all categories. You're looking at not only home appliances, but also soft lines, apparel, things like cosmetics, footwear. They're stumbling in a lot of different areas, and the movement towards the Sears hometown stores or that Sears hometown format hasn't been as efficacious as they once thought. When you look at large appliances and you look at the world of e-commerce, a lot of people now, when they shop for a large appliance, they will go to the store, as we've mentioned, perhaps try out that product, whether it's a range or a dishwasher or a washer or dryer set. And then they will eventually search online for the best price that they can find. And just in a sampling of five large appliance items across the full spectrum of large appliances, Sears lost out to Lowe's and Home Depot on every single one. And that's not even including other participants in the large appliance space and local chains. So Sears cannot compete on price. Additionally, their fulfillment is slower than the other businesses, oftentimes in Lowe's and Home Depot, some of those areas where you're beginning to see growth. And Sears is struggling to turn things around in their apparel categories. They, to this point, have been acknowledging their apparel faults, but despite everything that they've tried, whether it's sales or whether it's going back to different styles or trying to tap into different fashion markets, they haven't had anything reverse this trend simply because they're seeing a loss in number of customers coming through the doors. So, bad sign for Sears. When you look at Kmart, same store sales only fell 3.3%, as we mentioned. Now, that's not healthy by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not as drastic as Sears' negative 7% same store sales numbers are. Part of the stemming in decline for same store sales comes from the fact that Kmart has closed so many underperforming stores over the last 12 months. At the same time, you could really define most stores as underperforming, considering that we're not seeing sales growth as yet, but at least there are brighter signs for Kmart's. Kmart is really struggling with competition in certain categories. They're struggling in the pharmaceutical categories with CVS and Walgreens, with HBA. They're struggling in grocery with the Super Kmart franchise, with Walmart and Kroger dominating grocery, and where most of the Super Kmarts are, Meijer stores are more popular in any case. And then, as we mentioned, Best Buy is actually growing their consumer electronic sales, not only online, but also in stores. So they're seeing pressure in all these different areas. Where Kmart has always had success has been in their seasonal merchandise mix and oftentimes their soft lines, especially when it comes to home goods, towels, linens, curtains, that type of thing. So Kmart needs to perhaps refocus on those things and put their eggs into that basket. They've got good competition in that regard from Target, which is known as a pretty good soft lines retailer. But Kmart, when they were having success in those areas, they had large partnerships with companies like Martha Stewart Living, and you'd like to see them tap back into that a little bit. You figure they're never going to win at grocery, that groceries in the Kmart stores are more of a convenience to the consumer, and you'd like to see them pour more resources into the things that have worked in the past for Kmart and could possibly work in the future.
I definitely think that grocery is an area where they could actually start to focus a little bit more. You know, years ago when they restructured the insides of their stores, they did want to refocus on the grocery segment. I think just to say that it's going to be hard for them to compete is a valid point, but I think it's also saying that they should just give up, and I don't think they should quite give up yet. Just in April of 2016, as we had talked about on the Retail Focus podcast, Kmart had announced it's closing an additional 68 stores for 2016. I believe those store closings are complete, and I think, you know, the lower store count will allow them to focus on reinvigorating some segments such as groceries, soft lines, and apparel. So I think that's a definite opportunity for Kmart to rebound here. But along with the apparel note, I think that Sears is really acknowledging their loss of strength, as you had mentioned. Sears is actually launching a showcase shop-in-shop apparel boutique, and this is actually from an article that was released on the Retail Dive. The store is going to be about 10 to 15,000 square feet. Again, it's a store within a store, so they really see an opportunity here to really boost their apparel business, and I feel like they can transfer that over to those Kmart stores, perhaps having a store within a store there. But it's going to cost a lot of money for them to do that. For now, it's just going to be within 5 New York area stores, and it's going to happen this fall, and they're going to feature both men and women's clothing at discounted prices between $10 at $175 price point. So they feel like they can really promote this and get ahead of the curve, especially when it comes to fall fashion. I just don't think that this is necessarily the answer, especially when you're talking about a huge capital expenditure for Sears. But to that point, it looks as though they received another $300 million credit line from CEO Eddie Lampert's ESL Investments, Trent. This is going to be in addition to the $500 million line they received just a few months ago.
Eddie Lampert's hedge funds are really financing the losses here from Sears and Kmart. You look at, since April, Sears and Kmart combined have acquired $750 million in debt financing, and also they've submitted a proposal of late that says that the company may take an additional $200 million of debt on from other investors. So you're looking at total outstanding debt perhaps hitting near $1 billion or $950 million. And we talked a little bit before this podcast about how other investors apparently are loaning money to Sears. You understand why Eddie Lampert might be betting on himself. It might not be comfortable for that hedge fund to be betting on it. But you wonder what other investors are seeing here that would cause them to loan money to Sears and assume they might get it back. It seems like we're only a little bit of time removed from a possible bankruptcy or more closures for the company. There are not many positive signs overall. You know, going back to grocery for Kmart, one of the things that I wanted to mention is not so much that Kmart should give up on the grocery front, but rather they're having trouble with store traffic to the extent that they're losing a lot of money on inventory shrink from the grocery side of things. They just don't bring in enough customers specifically for that grocery. And we're seeing the same problems with Target, who is a company that's in a lot better shape financially than Kmart and a lot better shape in terms of their customer base. When you look at their market cap, as you mentioned, they're approaching a five-year low, right around $1.54 billion. And keeping in mind they've got all of this debt, things are beginning to look very damaging for Sears. However, I kind of want to end our discussion about Sears by asking you, Leighton, how long do you think this company will still be around? How long do you give Sears and Kmart to exist? Can they turn it around, or are we going to see them shutter their doors in the next decade?
It's funny you ask that, because if you had asked me that 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said about 1 to 2 years, but they're still around. And so if you just look at their high debt levels, though, it's a bad sign. Really, the heart here is that the debt is going to be leveraged against cash and cash equivalents, inventory, and future cash flows. And so that's never a good sign when you're highly debt leveraged as they are, close to $950 million in debt if they approve that secondary $200 million loan here that we just discussed. So at that point, you're really thinking of the future may not be so clear for Sears going forward. But Eddie Lampert actually owns quite a bit of the stock. And so if you look at it just from that perspective and how his hedge fund is so integrated with Sears, I think that it's going to be a while before you actually see a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. I think that Sears, as for a stock, is probably not advisable. I'm not a financial advisor, but if you just look at their stock price as of this recording, it's hovering around $14 a share, and that's almost an all-time low. As you mentioned before, a $1.5 billion market cap. So there's really not any huge growth built into this stock. I think that the company itself could be around for quite some time. 2 to 3, 4 years would actually not surprise me at this point. But is it a viable company, one that has growth within its future? I don't think so.
I don't see it closing down as an entirety. I don't think you're going to see a Sports Authority-esque just complete shuttering of doors for all Sears and all Kmarts. But I do, as I kind of alluded to earlier, feel like something's going to have to happen because synergies just aren't being created between the two businesses. And I think, honestly, that Kmart and Sears would both probably reap more benefits from going it alone. We hardly ever see that be the case in terms of the retail universe. But certainly here you can see signs where each business is perhaps dragging the other down. But I do think we'll see Sears and Kmart continue in some iteration, whether it's selling off their brick and mortar assets and continuing just in e-commerce, or maybe just Kmart, or maybe just Sears continuing to exist in the future. Well, moving on, Big Lots posted earnings this last week, and once again, they posted guidance-beating profitability, but they did miss slightly on top-line revenue expectations for their fiscal second quarter. The company reported adjusted earnings per share of 52 cents that beat the Zacks consensus estimate of 45 cents per share. However, their top-line revenues did miss by about $16 million, and what's more is they declined 0.5% from the year-ago figure. Now, we know Big Lots has been closing some underperforming stores and moving others. There's been a lot of motion on the Big Lots front as they begin to put more emphasis on their consumable goods. What does this earnings report mean for Big Lots?
I think it means a lot of things. I think, one, it really shows investors and analysts that they are executing well operationally. You see that EPS number raise up year over year. It's up 26.8%. So they are being very profitable. But the problem here for Big Lots, and we'll talk about this a little later, is that top line revenue number. Even the company expected $1.21 billion for the second quarter. But again, their revenues came in at $1.203 billion billion dollars. And so they missed not only analysts' expectations here with this number, but also their own expectations. They actually beat their own expectations to a higher degree. So that means they're not really working well on the promotion front and driving foot traffic into their individual stores. But the bright spots for Big Lots occur within segments such as furniture, mattresses, upholstery, and case goods. But these have often been the top performers for Big Lots. Something that you and I talked about off air is how they have such an opportunity to compete on the grocery front. They, as of late, have been really adding to their product selection. You see a lot of organic and all natural goods within their grocery segment, yet it's not really a highlight of these earnings calls. So this is something that I would like to see in the future. And I really think if they really focus on that and bringing customers to the store for grocery merchandise, let's say on the way home from work, they can really drive those other sales and get customers to not only buy those groceries, but to acknowledge how strong they are in those furniture and upholstery categories. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for Big Lots, and people do have to remember they're coming up on comparables that are compared to when they had higher store count. So this time last year, they had not yet closed all of their underperforming locations. But just to see that their profit is much higher means that closing those underperforming locations was a good idea. They're able to really focus on those stores that have already performed well historically. And so for comparison, this last quarter, they hit 0.3% in same-store sales growth. Last year, they hit 2.8%. So they do need to focus on bringing up those better stores to an even higher degree. And for the first quarter, they were at 3% same-store sales for this year. And so that's a number they were probably expecting, and that's probably why they missed on top-line revenue.
One of the phrases that they stated over and over, not only in terms of their latest earnings release, but also on their investor relations website, is they are positioned to grow. They feel like after closing those underperforming locations, after maneuvering around on the international front, that they're really in a position to succeed. When you look, though, at the numbers from this earnings, you see, of course, increased sales or success in some of the areas you talked about. And they feel like they have strength in merchandising as well as site selection for their individual stores, or at least that they're better at site selection now than they were several years ago. They also talk about distribution strengths, and that's something that we've seen from Big Lots as they continue to open new distributorships and areas like the one they opened, for example, outside of Columbus, Ohio, earlier this year. But really, when you look at their strength in merchandising, you see obviously that they're better than a lot of other off-price stores are, but there's always room for improvement. And the integration in consumables in those stores, as we've talked about several times over the past year, has been somewhat slow. When you look at many other retailers, what they do is they try to make it very apparent that they have some of these consumable goods so that they are a stop on the way home for, say, milk or eggs. But in many Big Lots locations, because the refrigerated goods section was added after the store was actually built, some of these locations have milk, have eggs, have the frozen goods in awkward areas in the store. And I think that might be stemming off some of the growth that they could be experiencing in these categories.
Yeah, absolutely. If you go into a Big Lots, typically you have to walk all the way to one side of the store to experience those groceries and to see those new coolers that they've put in place there. But just now, if you look at their most recent weekly ad, it really highlights their big furniture category. And I don't think that that's necessarily the way to go. Obviously, in certain markets, you don't have food items that are consistent across the entire U.S., but I think that they should really be highlighting some of those newer grocery items that are consistent market to market. As far as their position to grow, I really don't see a big future for them because recently they've been consolidating stores. And I think you were going to mention this. They ended up closing 78 stores in Canada and 2 distribution centers. And this was not but 3 years ago. And so they've already cut international growth. They've cut domestic growth. And they really have been stagnating as far as same store sales is concerned. So if they're positioned to grow and they say they've really outlined a large growth plan, I really don't see how they're going to execute. Overall, they have 1,400 locations within the U.S., a huge amount of locations, but they need to be able to manage these in such a way that people are coming to the stores on a routine basis. I think Big Lots isn't necessarily a destination for a lot of folks, and I think that's where they're having struggles. If you're competing with the likes of Dollar General, Dollar Tree, and Walmart all at the same time, it is going to be a hard environment to stand out. But just again, if you look at their most recent promotions with their weekly advertisements, it's the same thing that you were seeing 2 years ago. And so I think they could really be more creative on this front. And again, we mentioned this only one time before, but their social media presence isn't that strong. I feel like that's an opportunity for them to really take advantage of a growing, emerging marketplace where people are striving for deals via social media. And so if you look at social media overall, that really is a cheap avenue for a company to stand out. And this is in contrast to the weekly ad. You could probably spend very few dollars to get strong social media campaigns behind Big Lots. I have yet to see such a campaign from the company.
You know, here's where I think you and I are in slight disagreement regarding Big Lots. I understand why they feature furniture so prominently within their ad, because the store feels as though the furniture category, not only are they competitive and not only do they already have strong sales there, but that can serve as a conduit to new customers. There are not many competitors in the off-price furniture space that have a presence. If you live in certain markets, you can go to an Ollie's Bargain Center or other discount outlets, but Big Lots is one of the few stores in the off-price furniture category that actually has a nationwide presence. And when you look at the differences in terms of price between some of Big Lots' quality furniture that they sell, not just the stuff that comes in a box that you assemble at home, but things like couches, things like mattresses, and other stores, there is a remarkable price difference. So if Big Lots can drive that home to the consumer, they can get people in the stores for what could perhaps be the first time, and hopefully not the last time. While they're in the store, while they're looking at furniture, maybe something else catches their eye and they notice the food and that type of thing on their way out of the store. So I understand why they look at furniture as a category that could potentially lead to store growth. But as you said, that's something that they've got to drive home, not only in the freestanding inserts, but in my opinion, I would also be emphasizing that in a great way on social media. Although some of their social media campaigns do seem to catch on just slightly, they haven't done quite the job in social media as others in their category. TJ Maxx comes to mind, as others have. When you look at Big Lots overall, they do have over 1,400 locations in the U.S., and that's something that certainly that they can use to their advantage. But now the real question is, where are they positioned to grow? A lot of the company's focus has been in same-store sales, but we haven't seen a whole lot of expansion outward over the last year since they closed some of these underperforming locations. When you look at the news stories and some of the things that they've published on their website, it seems like planned growth as far as new locations opening is somewhat slowed down.
Yeah, again, it's going to be something that we're going to keep a keen eye on for quarters 3 and 4 of this year to really see if they can boost that foot traffic and to see exactly how they do it. But as for the stock, since Big Lots is a publicly traded company, the stock actually fell around 7.5% after the report came out Thursday after the bell. And really, this shows how investors were disappointed in possibly that same store sales or that top line growth. I feel like overall, this is a reset for the company. The shares are now trading at around $49 a share, so they have not actually rebounded since the pre-earnings trading. They were trading around $54, $55 a share before the earnings release came out, and the stock is still kind of hemorrhaging from that. But overall, the company has a $2.17 billion market cap, so even larger than the Sears and Kmart that we were just talking about previously, about 30% bigger than that company. But again, this is going to be a story we're going to keep our eyes on. They've done a lot in the past that makes it look like they're on a good path, but this is something, again, with the sheer amount of locations that they have a lot of leverage here to get customers into their stores, but it's up to them as to how they execute.
They have a store presence chart on their corporate site, and you can see from state to state in the U.S. how many Big Lots stores there are. And in every single state over the last 2 years, you've seen basically stagnating or negative growth in terms of number of stores. So if they truly are positioned to grow, they need to do something about actually expanding the number of stores. They can focus on same-store sales as much as they want, but as we see, same-store sales have begun to taper off in terms of their improvement. They've lost in total 44 stores in the U.S. since 2013. So this is something that Big Lots is going to have to look at, especially now with some of these new and improved distribution centers they have in place.
Well, moving on to our last earnings call for this edition of the Retail Focus podcast. Both Dollar General and Dollar Tree reported their second quarter earnings this last Thursday. Dollar General this month actually celebrated their 13,000th store opening, and it occurred in Birmingham, Alabama. And for this, they actually ran a promotion that was pretty strong on social media. But with Dollar General, the growth is actually being driven by net sales increases due to all these store openings, as top line revenues increased 5.8%. But same-store sales grew only 0.7%. So actually a similar stagnation of same-store sales compared with one of their competitors, Big Lots, who we just talked about. But overall, that top-line revenue did increase because they have a higher store count. With the same-store sales, Trent, are they going to be a little hesitant on continuing to grow out the amount of stores that they have?
Well, that's something that was included within the release that I think was glossed over by a number of media outlets. Their CEO said that they still want to maintain strict expense control discipline, which includes on the staffing portion, and we'll get to that in a second. But they also want to implement action plans in merchandising and store operations with an eye towards increasing same-store sales. You feel like they've certainly emphasized growing outward, increasing their number of locations, as you mentioned, to over 13,000 now as they've opened one, or they are getting ready to open one in North Dakota. But at the same time, same-store sales only up 0.7%. With that many locations, it's unlikely that you'll see too big of a spike in same-store sales in the neighborhood of even 2 to 3%. So 0.7 is not bad. And their top line revenue increased, but more importantly, their margins increased. Their earnings per share rose 14% to $1.08 in terms of earnings per share, which is higher than might be indicated just given their top line revenue and their same store sales increase. All of that being said, there are many statements in their earnings release from their CEO that suggest that they are looking more towards increasing same-store sales in the last two quarters of this fiscal year. And he said they're going to do it through perhaps their merchandising action plans. Merchandising help is sorely needed at Dollar General. If you look at one store that could use help in terms of merchandising that maybe isn't struggling financially, I think Dollar General certainly comes to mind. I know the last half dozen Dollar General stores I've been to across multiple markets have been somewhat messy. There was one store you couldn't even navigate the aisles because what they had done was they had taken the overstock merchandise and taken some Sterlite totes off the shelf and just dumped the overstock merchandise in the totes. So you would go down an aisle. We actually tweeted a picture out of this on a Retail Focus podcast Twitter feed at Retail Podcast. And you can see there are in some aisles four or five totes in the aisle, making it impossible to pass through with a shopping cart and even difficult to navigate as you're walking through the aisles. They need to do something with their merchandising above and beyond what's already going on. And part of that is the staffing issue. Most Dollar General stores, any given time, you've only got one to two staff members working in the store. So you don't get a lot of time if you're a staff member to face, and you can't move that far away from the register in order to face the store because you've always got to remain close in case a customer needs to check out. And sometimes you do see a backup at the point of sales system simply because of that. So helping out with merchandising, that's all great, and you can create as many plans as you want. But really, when we're talking about merchandising plans, we're talking about implementation of the plan, not just coming up with a plan. And the only way you can effectively implement a plan is by staffing your stores and then managing to retain the staff. And I suppose, Leighton, that's an area that they're also struggling in.
Overall, employee turnover is an area of opportunity for Dollar General stores. But as you had mentioned, if they're going to have any sort of new merchandising action plans, it is really key that you have the staff in order to implement it. You have to have adequate staffing, a staff that's not always rushing around because they're short-handed. And I think that's a problem that I've personally seen within the market that I live. There's over two dozen Dollar General stores. And if you go into one, oftentimes I think the associates are just trained to, if they're manning a register and no one's in the line, to start stocking. And I don't think that that's necessarily how to be an efficient company. I think you have to have dedicated staffers that are always going to keep the store stocked and looking well. I think if you have a merchandising plan that's really optimistic and clear and focused, you can only implement it when you have adequate people there to do so. I think that that's definitely, again, an area of opportunity. And when I spoke to a general manager of a Dollar General, she said exactly that. She said that employee turnover was hurting their ability overall to keep normal items on the shelf. And so if you go into a typical Dollar General, you'll see boxes strewn about, people rushing around trying to get them off the floor, get things stocked that are in high demand. And I think that she has noticed that in the last 2 years that that's been a recurring problem. So perhaps they could focus on maybe some reinvestment within their human capital, maybe increase the base wages that employees start out at, because that does seem to be a constant problem for Dollar General. And I think that could be an area where Walmart's really coming in and taking advantage of this format. You see reports of Walmart potentially trying to fight even harder on price as the holiday season comes about in quarters 3 and 4. And I think that added pressure of Dollar General is going to divert some traffic. And especially if you have bad merchandising behind it, people that are going to the stores aren't going to leave with a positive impression if they're having problems with the inventory and keeping merchandising up to snuff.
Both Dollar General and Dollar Tree, who we'll talk about in a second, reported either lower or stagnant payroll expenses, which is bucking the trend we see in retail generally, where you're seeing wage inflation come in for a couple of major retailers, and Walmart even calling wage inflation or offering larger wages perhaps a growth strategy. Not only in terms of implementing merchandising could retention and perhaps creating more employee positions and investing in human capital help out Dollar General, but also one of the reasons they cited regarding margins not increasing as much as they could have was increased shrink. Increased shrink, of course, comes because you've only got 1 to 2 staff members in every store, and you can't put everything under lock and key, because then, once again, you put pressure on your point of sale experience. So Dollar General's facing a lot of issues here. Most of them have to do with that human capital you mentioned, with their staffing. The other issue with Dollar General that you see noted in this earnings release is that they had a greater proportion of overall sales be from consumables, and those are areas that have smaller margins. The funny thing is about this earnings release versus what we've heard about Dollar General over the last month or two is we've heard over the last month or two they want to invest in selling more consumable goods, even making forays into produce and more so into dairy. However, these areas have low margins, so investing in these areas for Dollar General can be somewhat risky if you're already citing fairly low margins and high shrink on that particular product due to things like spoilage. So it's an interesting line that Dollar General kind of has to toe here, and I'll be anxious to see, certainly over the next 2 quarters, whether we do see that same-store sales growth that the company is aiming for. When you look at Dollar Tree, their sales increased 65.9%. That's a little bit tricky to navigate, though, because they did bring in $1.8 billion in net sales from the Family Dollar stores that they acquired during the last quarter. So sales went from $3.01 billion to $5 billion. The other $190 billion that made up the difference came from new store openings and also a 1.2% increase in Dollar Tree same-store sales. So a lot of positive going on from Dollar Tree, higher same-store sales number, and it seems as though they may not be having quite the issues that Dollar General is having with shrink on merchandise. In fact, that was something that wasn't even mentioned in the release, is keeping their margins down or holding their margins back.
Yeah, just to see that their same-store sales increase was 1.1%, almost double that of Dollar General, is a positive sign for Dollar Tree. Again, $5 billion from $3 billion for the prior year second quarter. However, that was, again, with the Family Dollar stores in the fold. But overall, a very positive story for Dollar Tree. For me, if you look at just the expenses, selling, general, and administrative expenses were 23.1% of sales, and this compared to 24.3% of sales. This overall percent was something I actually expected to be higher year over year, quarter over quarter, because of the Family Dollar acquisition. Typically, when you're changing some of the stores' names and you're trying to find the synergies for the distribution channels, something like this may be a little bit expensive on that selling, general, and administrative front. But overall, they've been able to manage quite well, and they say that this acquisition of Family Dollar was actually meeting or exceeding their expectations overall. So again, something very positive from Dollar Tree, and I think this is really a sign of great things to come for the company. The company noted that this was the 34th consecutive quarter of positive same-store sales growth, and so I think in the quarters to come, if there is going to be a dollar store segment that falters on this, it's going to be Dollar General. Overall, Dollar Tree looks to be the stronger of the two, and they're even bucking the wage inflation trends that other retailers are reporting. Again, you're seeing that higher human capital investment has been actually hurting the bottom lines of some of their major competitors, but Dollar Tree is not seeing the effects of this at all.
No, again, they did report lower payroll expenses. When you look at their margins, they're already seeing this economy of scale and synergy-related boost. Their margins increased 1.9% over the second quarter of fiscal year 2015. Dollar Tree's profit alone, when you look at just the Dollar Tree stores, saw a 9.2% boost. And this includes $60 million in costs that were associated with revising their overall product assortment after the acquisition, and also preparation for liquidation at certain Family Dollar stores that were seen as redundant or that were closing. When you look at Bob Sasser and what the Dollar Tree CEO has been able to do since the acquisition of Family Dollar, it's been rather remarkable. A lot of the change in terms of marketing has gone very smoothly. A lot of rebranding has gone smoothly. They were able to rebrand 47 former Family Dollar stores to Dollar Trees over the last quarter, and they also converted what was left of Deals stores, which is 32 stores remaining in that chain, to Dollar Tree stores as well. In addition to that, they opened 156 stores during the quarter, expanded or relocated 52 stores, and closed just 17 stores. So we're still seeing massive store growth here for Dollar Tree, and they're doing all of this while they're also focusing on smoothing over anything that could have taken place during the course of that Family Dollar acquisition. And really, despite the fact that same-store sales aren't going through the roof, again, this is a big enough company where you're going to see some normalization of same-store sales across the board for Dollar Tree. And you've really got to commend management for not only pulling off the acquisition, but making sure that they realized all the synergies that were out there, making sure that their supply chains were strong, and making sure that their existing stores see growth as well.
Absolutely. And I think the shareholders really responded favorably. Overall, the company operating now over 14,000 stores, 14,129 from this earnings report, in 48 states and 5 Canadian provinces. And so obviously this is going to include all the Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree Canada stores, and actually over 1,000 more stores than Dollar General. So I'm sorry we keep comparing the two, but it is vital to get the big picture here. For the longest time, people were saying that Dollar General was going to be the purveyor in this category, and it looks as though Dollar Tree is taking over. Dollar Tree taking over, again, with more positive same-store sales than Dollar General, dealing with a higher amount of locations, and integrating Family Dollar into the fold successfully. So they have the highest profitability, too, coming in. Net income for the first 6 months increased $431.3 million, and this was actually compared to the prior year's first 6 months. They came in with net income of $1.70 per diluted share. So overall, shareholders are going to be the beneficiary of this. However, the stock isn't responding so well. The stock is actually down slightly from this earnings call. The stock is now trading around $83 a share, where they were actually cresting above $90 prior to this earnings release. So I don't know what shareholders were quite expecting here. Perhaps maybe better same-store sales numbers or better top-line growth, but I think everything's coming in line with company expectations overall. And again, they're going to be really strong in the quarters to come as they see the synergies from the Family Dollar acquisition come through. And to be honest, a lot of stores have been struggling in the Canadian market, and Dollar Tree is not one of them. They have quite a successful track record in Canada, and that's something else to keep an eye on going forward.
We move north of the border for our next story. Alimentation Couche-Tard Incorporated, a leader in the Canadian convenience store industry, just bought CST Brands Incorporated, which is actually an American convenience store chain with over 2,000 locations in the southwestern United States. If you're not familiar with CST Brands, they actually own the Corner Store banner. They have licenses with Valero, Diamond Shamrock, and Subway, among others. So they have a number of convenience stores in the southwestern United States, most of them operating under the Corner Store banner. And now when you look at this acquisition of CST Brands, this gives Couche-Tard not only a holding in Corner Store, but also Circle K, which is another one of their brands.
Absolutely. This is going to be massive. We weren't too familiar with Couche-Tard before this release, but it turns out that they were actually looking to acquire some more brands within the United States over the past 6 months. And so CST is actually quite large here with a massive presence, over 2,000 gas stations alone in the southwestern United States. Just a massive presence that we, again, were very unaware of. But this deal is actually going to be an all-cash deal, about $4.4 billion for Couche-Tard, and they're going to be paying a pretty significant premium for CST. CST was actually a publicly traded stock, and they're going to be paying around $48.53 a share. However, this is a 42% premium to CST's closing price from about the first week of March. So this was about the time that the board of directors for CST were saying that they were looking for strategic alternatives to really capitalize and give back some shareholder value there, basically saying that they were looking for a buyer of their brand, and it looks as though they found one. This has yet to go through regulatory approval and shareholder approval, but it looks like the deal is all but finalized. For the completion, it looks as though Couche-Tard's Circle K division within the United States is actually going to be managing this unit, and they're going to be creating a new business unit set up and headquartered in San Antonio, Texas, and they're going to be looking to integrate their operations and have this be as smooth as possible. But just the sheer amount of locations that Couche-Tard had previously is astounding. Over 12,000 locations for the business, and this is actually a global business. While they're headquartered in Canada and they're on the Canadian stock market, they have a presence in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as many Asian markets as well. This is something that really opened my eyes. And to top it all off, they just announced this last Tuesday, 53 additional sites were going to be acquired from American General Investments, LLC, and North American Financial Group. And these sites are going to be in Louisiana, around the Baton Rouge area. And so about 12 quick service restaurants branded for Cracker Barrel. And all but one of the sites is going to be branded under Motor Fuels under Shell, Chevron, or Cracker Barrel. Of the 53 sites, 47 of which are going to be wholly owned, and the rest are actually going to be leased out. So they're looking to ever expand their footprint within the United States. And overall, this should push them past about 14,100 locations globally, having about 100,000 employees. Just a massive convenience store company that I was unaware of, but really a big player in the space now. And I'm curious to see how they're able to leverage the buying now that they own so many stores in the United States.
We should keep in mind, too, that the CST acquisition isn't fully completed. They'll still need to send out proxy statements to the SEC and the shareholders. But when you look at CST's holdings, and more particularly their Corner Store banner, their stores are much bigger than the average Circle K store is in the United States. It's a larger, more open square footage floor plan, oftentimes with a number of built-in refrigerators. Not unusual for a convenience store. It's just that the Corner Store format particularly has a good deal more refrigerated space than your traditional Circle K. So it'll be interesting to see how that will work out now with Circle K helping to operate Corner Store locations out of San Antonio. When you look at the footprint for CST Brands, as we mentioned, they're more in the southwest United States. They do have locations in Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, as well as New Mexico and Arizona, but they do stretch as far north as Wyoming and as far west as California. So this is a huge pickup for Couche-Tard. And more importantly, this gives them something to work with their Circle K holdings, many of which are in the same area. Circle K, perhaps their biggest U.S. state, you could make the argument that it's Arizona. So an interesting job of seeking out possible potential future synergies for Couche-Tard, and you wonder how this will impact not only the layout of Corner Store, but also some of their partnerships with Cibolo Mountain and Subway and other brands in the future.
Absolutely. And I'm curious to see if they have any rebranding of these 2,000 locations. Within the U.S., I had mentioned that they will have over 14,000 locations globally, but Just for the U.S., they have over 7,800 locations, and this is before the closing of this deal. So overall, they should have about 10,000 locations in total with the closing of the deal in Louisiana and the CST Brands deal. So overall, that should give them about 8 to 9,000 gas stations. Again, 10,000 convenience stores overall. And as you had mentioned, a lot of synergies are going to come about, and they obviously see some opportunity here, although it's not really clear as to how they're going to go about it. But they are a big operator globally, and they have a lot of experience with expansion via acquisition. So this is something that isn't new to them, and they're going to find a lot of ways to build out value from this. So again, they are publicly traded. Their Class B stock from this deal announcement is up over 17%. And this was after months of rumors that this deal was actually going to happen. So they are on the Canadian stock market, and their stock is currently trading at around $68 a share, which is actually its all-time high. So just a massive company with great expectations built into the stock, and shareholders are apparently loving what they see in terms of all the U.S. acquisition. Moving on to our last story here for the Retail Focus, Amazon Books has officially announced plans to open its fourth location in Chicago. This was after rumors about 7 or 8 months ago that they were planning on opening hundreds of brick and mortar locations in the U.S. So this news really indicates that they're actually going to grow rather slowly, but this fourth location is actually going to be in addition to their first location that they opened up in Seattle and two under development, one in San Diego and one in Tigard, Oregon, right outside Portland. So really, they're looking to those bigger metropolitan locations, and it's kind of going to be a safe way for them to expand this and really get a feel for how customers are experiencing these smaller store footprints.
Yeah, again, expansion perhaps not as quick as everyone had rumored. Now, Amazon themselves never necessarily said that they were going to have hundreds of locations or anything like that within a couple of years. But this is a very popular neighborhood in Chicago, the Lakeview neighborhood. And they have one, of course, brick and mortar location that's open in Seattle. One is coming soon to the Portland metro area and also to San Diego. So they're very obviously picking and choosing their locations carefully. What's interesting about this location in Chicago, it's within a couple miles of four total independent bookstores. So it'll be interesting to see how the folks in that Lakeview neighborhood, and the Lakeview neighborhood, by the way, is known for not necessarily shopping at chain stores, but rather is big into shopping at independent type stores. It'd be interesting to see how that neighborhood takes to an Amazon brick and mortar location. I think this is a good example for those that say that the future will be exclusively e-commerce. Amazon realizes that they need some sort of brick and mortar presence. There are a lot of things that can be realized with a brick and mortar presence, and it's true that you can't have a true omni-channel experience for consumers unless you are legitimately everywhere the consumer is, and part of that is having a brick and mortar location. One of the benefits of these Amazon locations is that they don't only sell books, but they also sell Amazon devices. The Kindle e-reader, Fire TV, and also the Amazon Echo are all things that can be integrated into these locations to make them more showrooms than anything else. We've seen Apple do this with certainly success in their retail segment, and I think that's where the success is going to be for Amazon. Not necessarily in books, although they can call themselves a bookstore, but I think in terms of the new and emerging technology that Amazon is beginning to offer consumers, I think giving consumers a chance to test drive that, so to speak, without having to first order it online is a benefit for that consumer and will make them more likely to jump for something like the Fire TV Stick or their e-readers.
It is a good thing to note for our listeners that are in that particular market that they aren't going to be selling just books. They're trying to branch out and think outside the box and are trying to influence the customers into getting an omni-channel experience in due time. So that's something that's going to be very important. But along with that, success will be measured in how they expand and where they expand. they're very careful into what markets and what areas of these cities they're going. And that's something that is going to be very important going forward for them. For about several months now, it's been rumored that they're going to be operating a location in Manhattan. So New York City is obviously going to be a target for one of these locations, but they haven't yet chosen a location. And because of that, they haven't made an official announcement. So I think that really speaks to how intelligent Amazon is when they're trying to find these locations and see where the demand is. But to be in between some independent booksellers there in the Chicago area is an interesting thing to note. However, they will be around some really good areas as far as demographics, just in the area you mentioned here in Chicago's historic Lakeview neighborhood. There's a lot of restaurants, a lot of younger people in the millennial demographic that are walking around. And so whether or not that store is profitable, I think they really just want to send out a note to those customers in that area saying, listen, just come in, try out our products. And if you want, buy something from Amazon.com while you're in the store. You don't necessarily have to make a purchase at that particular brick and mortar location. So I think Amazon is very smart in how they're going about this. And even more so, you see that they're taking their time and actually opening these locations. The locations that we previously mentioned in San Diego and Tigard, Oregon, they aren't even opened yet. So they're really taking their time. They want to build out proper merchandising since these are smaller footprint stores. They want to be able to utilize the space they have in a smart way. And so because of that, it's not going to be until early 2017 that they open this Chicago location. They didn't even give a specific timeline. I think one of the reasons for that was because it was an Irish-themed bar beforehand. As for Amazon and their overall strategy here, I don't foresee 200 or 300 locations in the next 2 years, but I do see maybe 40, 50 locations in prime areas where people are really getting positive vibes from these brick-and-mortar locations.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
All right, well, we've reached that point in the Retail Focus podcast where we each give you one news story that'll be on our radar for the next week or month. And Leighton, I understand a home improvement retailer might be using robots to deliver things to consumers?
Yeah, it's kind of scary, actually, but it was just announced yesterday that Lowe's is going to be having a robot at 11 of their locations in the San Francisco market. A robot's going to be called Lobot and is going to have the ability to speak multiple languages and is actually going to have lasers on it in order to identify humans walking in through the door. And it should be able to understand certain commands about products that the customer desires. So, for instance, if you walk into a Lowe's and you need directed to the paper towels, the Lobot should be able to walk you to that appropriate area. So the robot is actually packed with a 3D scanner as well and is made by a company called Fellow Robots. This was actually in response to what the company feels is a need. And an executive director of Lowe's Innovation Lab said, this is a response to things people wanted since retail began. But up until now, there just wasn't that technology to be able to make that happen. So I feel like this is going to be a step forward into the future some way, somehow. But already you've seen this in a lot of markets, particularly in Japan. Japan uses a lot of robots, particularly in the restaurant industry, to serve their customers. So this is a step in a scary direction, but they won't be having to pay those people on an hourly basis as they used to for this position. So they didn't say whether or not this is actually going to take from the normal personnel levels at those individual locations, but this is going to be interesting to see if it is successful and if it plays out accordingly.
I'd be anxious to see whether it's actually cost effective. There's a lot of argument that's out there that says that, you know, technology like this being so expensive might actually be more expensive in the long run than just paying an hourly employee, simply because there's maintenance costs involved. Anytime you've got technology like this, there's obviously malfunction concerns and that type of thing. So I'll be anxious to see how that pans out. I'm not sure, though, that I was clamoring for a robot to show me where the paper towels were in Lowe's, nor am I really excited to use that technology anytime soon.
Yeah, there's two things for me here. When I walk into a Lowe's, I just want to be in and out. And whether or not I can find something is one thing, but I don't want to have to wait on a robot to slowly usher me to a particular aisle. The second thing is they talk about reliability of associates. A lot of analysts were saying that this solves the common cold problem with associates calling in sick. However, as you had mentioned, there's going to be reliability problems with robots in the long run as well. Nothing is ever as reliable as it seems, but again, this is going to be something that we'll be keeping an eye on and definitely be looking to see its long-term viability.
Yeah, maintenance costs, always an issue with technology. Something inevitably will go wrong, no matter how new the technology. Well, my story comes out of Cincinnati. Steve Watkins, who's a staff reporter for the Cincinnati Business Courier, wrote an article that said that it could be that Kroger might be interested in purchasing nearly 500 Rite Aid locations if Rite Aid and Walgreens get the go-ahead on their acquisition deal. Originally, Kroger had rumored to be a potential buyer of Rite Aid years ago, but now Walgreens has been in the process of trying to purchase Rite Aid. Analysts say that Walgreens may have to sell off anywhere between 500 to 1,000 Rite Aid stores. Interesting to see how Kroger could use the smaller footprint of Rite Aid. It's not something that they've really experimented with too much to this point, except with some what they call urban supermarket outfits in certain metro areas. Hard to believe, though, that Kroger would purchase all 500 locations. It seems like a big jump for a company, even a company as large as Kroger. You know, it's interesting to note that one of the companies that we talked about earlier in the Retail Focus podcast, Dollar Tree, when they acquired Family Dollar, they had to sell off about 330 of the Family Dollar stores. They did so to private equity firm Sycamore Partners. Theoretically, those were supposed to be rebranded to Dollar Express stores. That hasn't happened yet. In fact, the only place Dollar Express exists is online, and the website Sycamore Partners has for Dollar Express is, I don't want to say necessarily juvenile, but somewhat rudimentary. So there's some question there as to what exactly are going on with those Dollar Express stores. You wouldn't be surprised if you saw this acquisition between Walgreens and Rite Aid go through, to see Rite Aid sold to a private equity firm and perhaps something different happen with those stores, or maybe those stores continue to operate under the Rite Aid brand.
This is interesting to me because we had talked about this a little bit before we started recording this podcast. Rite Aid stock is actually close to hitting a one-year high, and I think that's based off of this news. It's quite interesting, really, when you look at their overall store count. They have over 4,500 locations, and obviously, whether it's Kroger or Walgreens, people are seeing untapped potential within the Rite Aid brand. So if anything, Rite Aid shareholders are on the positive end of all of this, with the stock slowly increasing on this type of news.
Yeah, if nothing else, both Walgreens and Kroger interested in the real estate Rite Aid currently occupies, to say nothing of the brand. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. Be sure and follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast, and subscribe, as always, on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Podcast Republic, Podcast Addict, and any other podcast delivery services. For questions or comments, shoot us an email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. For Layton, I'm Trent. We'll see you in a couple of days when we release Food Focus.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.